I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. This hour, 50 years after Bloody Sunday in Selma, several days after President Obama's stirring speech in Selma, a week after the U.S. Justice Department's report on Ferguson, and now less than 24 hours after two Ferguson police officers were shot outside the Ferguson police station. We are going to talk about matters of race this hour of the program. We'll be starting with Ishmael Sistrunk. He's a columnist for the St. Louis American. It's an African-American newspaper that's been around since 1928. He grew up outside Ferguson. He's been with us several times before and has had his own negative encounters with the police in Ferguson. The Justice Department report was quite scathing, and there have been a series of resignations. The police chief has resigned. The investigators found evidence of racist jokes being sent around by Ferguson police and court officials. The Ferguson city manager stepped down on Tuesday. Two police officers resigned last week, and the city's top court clerk also resigned. There have been protests calling for the resignation of the mayor of Ferguson as well. We'll start with all of those issues. Later in this hour, presidential historian and journalist Jonathan Alter will join us. Jonathan was in Selma this past weekend. He walked the Edmund Pettus Bridge and rode the bus from Selma to Montgomery. He says President Obama gave the best speech of his presidency. Republicans and Democrats both agreed, those who were there. And he said there were signs that maybe something concrete could come from this trip, like Congress fixing the Voting Rights Act. We'll be welcoming your phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Before we meet Ishmael to lay the stage for what we're talking about this hour and put it in a broader context, here just a portion of President Obama's comments while he gave the commemoration speech in Selma. These comments directly related to Ferguson.
You know, just this week I was asked whether I thought the Department of Justice's Ferguson report shows that, with respect to race, little has changed in this country. And I understood the question. The report's narrative was sadly familiar. It evoked the kind of abuse and disregard for citizens that spawned the civil rights movement. But I rejected the notion that nothing's changed. What happened in Ferguson may not be unique, but it's no longer endemic. It's no longer sanctioned by law or by custom. And before the civil rights movement, it most surely was. We do a disservice to the cause of justice by intimating that bias and discrimination are immutable, that racial division is inherent in America. If you think nothing's changed in the past 50 years, ask somebody who lived through the Selma or Chicago or Los Angeles of the 1950s.
Ishmael Sistrunk is our first guest, columnist for the St. Louis American, an African-American newspaper that has been published since 1928. He grew up outside Ferguson and has had his own encounters with the police in Ferguson while he's been driving through that community over the course of many years. Ishmael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me once again.
Let's start with the news that came yesterday from Ferguson, two officers being shot outside the Ferguson police station Thursday morning. I don't think they have anybody yet, but it certainly is an indication that the protests are ever present, that there is a violent part of these protests, and that racial tension in this city, even though there have been some resignations, the Justice Department may have called for things to change, but there are going to be more protests, and a lot needs to happen for there to be significant change.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, what happened last night or early this morning is tragic. You never want to see anybody getting shot, law enforcement officials or protesters, and that, you know, there's never a good time for someone to get shot, but it was surprising that on the day that the police chief stepped down, that something like this would happen. And you're right. It just shows that there's always this potential for violence in these type of situations, and that's something that's really going to have to be addressed between the law enforcement officials and between the lawmakers and the citizens of Ferguson and the greater St. Louis County, to where we have to be able to have these conversations and work on these type of issues without having this fear of violence happening all the time.
You have had, it really looks as though the whole city structure is crumbling, and some would say good riddance to this structure, but you're going to have a restructuring of the whole police department and the city and the municipal courts. The report was so scathing that you're going to have huge change in Ferguson, aren't you?
Yes, yes, definitely. And unfortunately, it's not just limited to Ferguson. I mean, Ferguson has really gotten the national news, the eye of the national news, but it's really happening all around St. Louis County. This has been something that residents have talked about for years and generally have been ignored and said, no, you're just making things up. That's not really happening. But what the Department of Justice laid out in that report, that's no secret to the people of St. Louis and St. Louis County and of Ferguson. And to be honest, Ferguson actually probably isn't the worst of the bunch. There's approximately 90 different municipalities, cities, and townships in the St. Louis County area, and many of them have this same type of predatory way of handling the law, where they're revenue-driven instead of being driven to protect the citizens of those areas. So as long as that exists, there's going to be a real problem. So we really have to switch from these cities trying to raise revenue to trying to protect the people, because that's what the police are really there for.
And going beyond Missouri, I know the ACLU has done investigations of Connecticut, New York City, Minnesota, Boston, Newark, the list goes on, and have found great disparities. The number of minorities who've been arrested for fairly minor offenses compared to white people committing the same kinds of offenses, but the disparity in who gets arrested is huge.
Absolutely. And I think the frustrating part for citizens in those cities who live through that is there are often denials that come from either lawmakers or from police officers. In fact, I was watching a report this morning that had the head of the St. Louis Police Union, a gentleman by the name of Jeff Rorta, and he basically said, this was after the shootings, they were talking to him, and he basically said, well, he came out and said, Eric Holder's a liar, and this whole thing with Michael Brown has showed that people have been lying, and, you know, it's the fault of Eric Holder that these police officers were shot this morning. He said this on CNN, a national news station. And if you have police officers or police union chiefs, people in public positions of power who just refute the hardcore evidence that's out there, that's why you have a lot of distrust from the community. Because if we can't even acknowledge that there's a problem, even though the data is overwhelmingly showing that, then there's really no point where we can start a conversation to heal.
As you know, I started with President Obama's. He gave a beautiful speech, and we're going to talk about other aspects of that speech during the course of the hour. What did you think of his comments about Ferguson? Is it right for us to remember, and maybe it was on that occasion, that things have changed for the better? All you have to do is look at the lives of African Americans in the 1950s. Did he talk pointedly enough about racial disparity in that speech, or was he too light on the subject?
That's a very good question. I think he made valid points. It's very easy to look at the incidents that are happening, and especially now that we have social media, and it's not just the big news media that are able to get stories out. Really, the main reason that the Michael Brown story got such worldwide attention is because of Twitter. There were people who witnessed it, or people who were nearby, and they posted things on Twitter, and it just really caught fire. So it's easy to look at the things that are happening daily and say nothing has changed, but he's right. A lot has changed now. Back then, it wasn't illegal to do certain things. The laws were, now the laws are more covert. Back then the laws were overt, and it was really encouraged to discriminate, or it was encouraged to do these types of racist things. So we have come a long way, and like you said, anybody who grew up around that time can tell you that there is definitely a difference. I can go into any restaurant of my choosing right now and eat and not be discriminated against, pretty much. Back then that wasn't the case. But that said, there's still a long way to go, and I think that especially since President Obama has been in office, we've seen an uptick of these racial tensions that really need to be dealt with.
I've thought so many times, Ishmael, about the story you told us some months back of driving in Ferguson, and you've driven in Ferguson many times. This time you were driving through a snowstorm, and you were pulled over because you had snow on your license plate. Were you given a ticket for that?
I don't believe that I was. I was not given a ticket that time. I believe that was just used as an excuse to stop me and pull me over. The fact that I had my papers in order, that I had insurance, that I was not intoxicated, didn't do any drugs or anything like that. I think a lot of things that happen like that, especially in this region, it's really just to stop you and see what's going on, to try to see if there is something more. And that's what the Department of Justice report referenced, that 85% of the vehicle stops in Ferguson were African Americans, 90% of the citations and 93% of the arrests. I think it's just an excuse, a bad excuse. Really, it's unlawful, but they just try to find any type of way to stop you to see what's going on, if there is some type of offense that they can fine you for.
You mentioned this, but let's talk a little bit more about it. There were many statistics in the Department of Justice report showing that the police department viewed its black residents as a source of revenue for the city rather than as citizens who they should be protecting.
Right.
We've seen on the news many such cases of people who, had fairly minor kinds of offenses and they couldn't pay them, and then they couldn't go into certain jobs because they hadn't paid their ticket for parking a car illegally. I mean, there's case after case after case using all of these offenses to get revenue for the city.
Right. Yeah, and again, that's fairly standard practice, and that's something that is not a secret here. I have several friends and family members around who tell me stories about going to traffic court. The traffic courts here are ridiculous. There are literally lines out of the door. The courtroom is filled, there are lines out of the door. So, it's almost like people are going to try to buy iPhones or something. It's just this packed municipal court every Thursday or whatever day that the particular city has of people going to pay fines. And as the report showed, a lot of times it's not just one offense that they're given. They're cited for four or five different things, to where you end up, having about $500 or $600 worth of fines for something that was minor. Even in the instance of Michael Brown and his death, the initial stop for that was for him walking across the street, for him jaywalking, essentially. And regardless of, what happened or what you believe happened after that, he ended up losing his life for something that started with him crossing the street, not at a crosswalk.
Ishmael Sistrunk is our guest. He's the columnist for the St. Louis American, an African-American newspaper, and he has been writing about Ferguson for quite a few months now, and we're welcoming phone calls. We're looking at matters of race. It was also 50 years since Bloody Sunday in Selma, and a very moving weekend in Selma, Alabama, including the president's remarkable speech there. We'll be speaking with Jonathan Alter a little bit later. He was there for the whole weekend, and he talked to descendants of people who were involved in the march and members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, about how many people were so moved that they maybe would go back to Washington and fix the Voting Rights Act. We'll speak with Jonathan, who's a presidential historian, the second half hour. Here's how you reach our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have many phone calls for Ishmael, and let's start with Victor calling us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Victor.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
My comment is just, you know, I hate to admit it, but I've been a big fan of Cops for quite a while. And in light of everything that's going on today, I realized in watching the show the other night, I mean, it's primetime example of how certain elements of our law enforcement community use a certain element of our populace is just a source of revenue, people getting pulled over for really silly, ridiculous things, and the tickets just add up. People's cars getting confiscated or taken away and things like that, and people that really aren't in a position to pay these to begin with are unduly, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it doesn't seem just or equitable, and it's right there on TV for everybody to see.
Ishmael.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Cops definitely does highlight those type of activities and incidents. Excuse me. And you know, one thing that I noticed is that, you know, they generally are preying upon, like you said, people who are from a lower socioeconomic class, and so these people, they have difficulty to get off to go to court. I know here, at least locally, a lot of times some of these offenses have, you must appear in court. You can't just pay the ticket online or, you know, go in and make the payment. So you have to appear in court, so you have to pay that court cost. But if you're getting someone who has a part-time job or who has an hourly job, it's harder for them to get off work. Or if they do get off work, they're sacrificing money, income, to be able to go and pay those type of court costs. So it definitely is unfair to those who have less to have those type of fines.
What do you think the response has been to the Department of Justice report on Ferguson? What have they been ordered to do other than resignations that have taken place? What has been done to better the situation, Ishmael?
Well, the city of Ferguson, the Department of Justice, I mean, they made several strong recommendations, and I say that with air quotes because it's essentially mandates from the federal government of things that they need to change, and part of that is the focus on generating revenue. They have to make efforts to cease that. There had already been a law change where it limits the amount of revenue that a city can take in via fines. Me personally, I believe that any fines that are generated from traffic offenses or things like that, those should go elsewhere besides the police department. I think the police should be funded out of a completely separate fund because anytime you have it where they're able to profit off of ticketing residents, you get in the type of situation that we are. But I know that's one of the recommendations that the Department of Justice has made. They have talked about diversifying the police force. We know that there were only two black police officers at the time of the Michael Brown shooting. I know they have hired a few more African-American police officers since then, and they are still in the hiring process. And also just to stop the basic civil rights violations. I know Eric Holder in the report talked about how people were stopped, you know, as you mentioned, my situation, really for no reason, just because, you know, the officers wanted to find out what they were doing or see if they could find a way to find them. So there's been things where people were ticketed for filming or arrested even for filming police officers. Now, that's something that the Supreme Court has upheld as First Amendment right. There are times where people, you know, talk back to police officers and they're arrested, or they're really just making any type of reason to get that revenue. So the Department of Justice is definitely trying to crack down on that to say, hey, you have to recognize and obey the citizens' civil rights.
You also had, and it's hard for me to understand why people like this were just fired and reprimanded immediately. It may seem like a small thing, but it's evidence of a culture in a place. The investigators finding these racist jokes that were being sent around by Ferguson police and court officials. Racist jokes were being circulated in the Milwaukee County Executive's office here in Milwaukee. And I read those and I thought, oh my gosh, how could anybody distribute such a thing and think that it was okay to do that and that you wouldn't lose your job over something like that?
Right. And the really scary part about it is these are people who are in control of your freedom. So the fact that if I were to send, you know, some type of racist joke or email or something like that, not that I ever would, but if I were to do that, that really doesn't impact somebody's freedom. That makes me a jerk, but that's all. But when a police officer is doing that, when someone who has the power to imprison you, when someone has the power to send you to jail for years or whatever, that's when it really gets scary, because then you start to wonder, you know, how legitimate are these things that are happening? How legitimate are these arrests? Are these fines? When you have people all the way up the ladder, and it's not just one person, as you find in their report, there are people all throughout that organization who have been found guilty of this. And again, I don't think that's just limited to Ferguson. It's just being turned up because there's such a fine-tooth comb that's going through there now.
Yeah. One more call on this for you, and let's go to Jeff in DePere. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I would like to ask your guest a question before I go to work here in a minute, 30 seconds. No, never mind, I got to go to work. My question is this. President Obama is being congratulated for the speech, and it's the best speech of his career, and he's talking about progress. So over 100 years, we've had many issues, 50 years, we've had many changes. Now, with the presidential candidates for next year, for instance, the current governor of Wisconsin is taking money from old. Obama and the Clintons were taking money from new, modern, progressive people, new billionaires, new millionaires. But Walker's backers are old guys that grew up in the 50s and 60s that no prejudice, no racism. Are we going to go ass backwards in this country with, say, for instance, Scott Walker and his money backers from Texas and California and Kansas?
All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. Well, everybody's taking money from Wall Street, right, Ishmael?
Right, yeah. Money and politics, that's a whole other conversation right there.
Yeah, it sure is. So are you hopeful when you read this report? Did you think, oh, this is good, this marks the beginning of significant change?
I was hopeful by the report. There was a sense of validation, again, even before Ferguson became on the national scene. This is a conversation that African-Americans have been having with one another for a long time, for decades, really. But there was always a sense of, of that it wasn't true by the establishment or by those in power. So this was a sense that, okay, what we've been saying all along is correct now. We've been vindicated in a sense. But it also was disappointing to see, as I talked about Jeff Reuter, or to see other police officials or mayors or politicians come out and basically deny and say, no, this isn't really a problem. I think before there's going to be any real progress, you have to admit that there's a problem. If you can't do that, then how can we have this discussion? How can we have this healing?
Ishmael, thank you very much for being with us. We always like to hear from you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, our pleasure. Ishmael Sistrunk, our guest the first half hour. Ishmael is a columnist for the St. Louis American. It's an African-American newspaper that's been published since 1928. He grew up, has spent his life living very close to Ferguson, and has driven through Ferguson many times as a young black man and was stopped. I'll tell this story again because I think it's so outrageous. Was stopped by the police many times, but on one occasion was stopped because there was snow on his license plate, and it was snowing. That'll happen. We continue our conversation. We're talking about matters of race this hour. It's also, as you know, 50 years after Bloody Sunday in Selma and several days after President Obama's amazing speech in Selma. Jonathan Alter was there, and he's written a really good piece for the Daily Beast titled Bloody Sunday Unites the Right and Left. And he talks about his vantage point for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. He was very moved by what he saw. He thought that President Obama gave the best speech of his life, his presidency, actually, probably his life, too, last weekend. And he had a chance to speak with many of the people who were involved either with the Bloody Sunday civil rights struggle or their descendants. And he talked with Republican members of Congress and Democratic members of Congress as well, and he's written about that. He's a presidential historian. He's been with us before talking about his books. He's the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One, and also The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And he has written another book, which is more of an update on President Obama's term in office. And he's with us. And I'm glad he is. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Good. How are you? What's the name of the second book about President Obama?
It's called The Center Hole.
Thank you.
Obama and His Enemies.
Thank you.
And it's really about the 2011-2012 period. Remember, after the shellacking, as he called it, in 2010 in the midterms, it looked to a lot of people like he would be a one-term president. So a lot of the second Obama book is about the way he fought back. Had his ups and downs, got bin Laden and that whole story, but also had a lot of frustrations with the Republican Congress, and then put together a state-of-the-art reelection campaign that I argue, really has changed politics in a profound way by really harnessing digital technology.
Yeah. Well, you had one extraordinary weekend, Jonathan.
I did. It was really a very memorable one, and also for some personal reasons. There's this trip, they call it a pilgrimage, that John Lewis, who, you know, is described as a living saint, a Republican member of Congress, described him this past weekend, his colleague John Lewis, who's a congressman from Georgia, as the moral conscience of the nation, quote unquote. And he had been, beaten badly on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 when he was leading the first march. And for the last 17 years, he's led a congressional delegation on this pilgrimage to various civil rights sites in the South. They always end up in Selma. This, because it was the 50th anniversary, it was a bigger one than normal. There were 100 members of Congress in our group, and 20 among them 25 Republicans, and so it was bipartisan. And because my wife and our son had been on the trip last year and had an amazing time, my daughter, who's a reporter for Time magazine, and I was reporting for Daily Beast, we signed up early, and we ended up as two of only three reporters who were allowed to travel with these members of Congress and ride around on the buses with them and, hang out with everyone from, Nancy Pelosi and Elizabeth Warren to Senator Tim Scott and a number of other politicians from both parties. And then we were up close at the president's speech, and then walked across the bridge afterward. So it was kind of like the embeds that you hear about in war, except this was for a commemoration. And it had special meaning for me, because when I was 9 years old in 1966 and growing up in Chicago, Dr. King came to our house
Really?
For an event, and oh. You know, I got his autograph.
Oh,
and,
my!
You know, it was a very obviously very memorable occasion for me. So I've, you know, had a special interest in the civil rights movement for a long time.
Yes. And the president gave such an incredible speech. I must say, somebody told me you need to watch this, and so I looked at it. It was on my computer, and I just sat right on the sofa and watched every minute. It was so stirring. It was really, you think, the speech of his presidency, don't you?
I actually would go further than that. I think it's the best speech he's ever given.
Really?
And, you know, I've known Barack Obama since he was an Illinois state senator, and my parents knew him when he was a community organizer. My late mother did, and so we've known him for a long time. And I followed all of his speeches, and you know, I wrote two books about him. And this was the best speech he's ever given. And I would urge anybody who is interested in Obama or considers themselves to be a progressive or liberal to watch the speech. And the reason is that what he does is he articulates what American patriotism is, and also articulates a liberal vision of America. And on top of that, owns the idea of American exceptionalism. Now, what do I mean by American exceptionalism? Well, this is something that has been a bone of contention between the president and his critics. People like Mitt Romney, more recently Rudy Giuliani, say, well, he's not patriotic, and the reason is he doesn't believe that we're an exceptional nation, that we are the greatest nation in the world, right? He doesn't believe that, and therefore he's running down America, he's not patriotic, and we should all, realize this about him, that he's an alien, he's the other, he's not one of us, This is what they've been hammering on the president for more than 6 years now. So what President Obama did was he said, okay, let's talk about exceptionalism. And to say, essentially, I agree, we are an exceptional nation. That doesn't mean that we're, better than every other nation in the world, but we are an exceptional nation, unusual, and in some senses better. And the reason that we're better is because we learn from our mistakes and we grow and we change and we, and throughout American history, and he took us on a little trip through American history.
Yes, he did.
See that, so he put Selma in that context, and the ability to protest, dissent, argue, speak our minds, petition the government for a redress of grievances, as the Constitution says. These things are not outlier ideas. These are not things for, hippies and minorities. This is the essence of the American idea. And so he created a new context for thinking about who we are, what it means to be a patriotic American, and it ended up being a very patriotic speech, and this is our greatness, is that we could go from, as John Lewis said when he was introducing the president, he said, there he is standing on the bridge where he was beaten silly, was not allowed to cross the bridge peacefully. And he said, if somebody had told me then that I would be introducing an African-American president,
right,
on this bridge, I would have said, you're crazy, you're out of your mind. And that the fact that we have done that, even though it's not enough, we have a lot of problems, Ferguson illustrates some of them, we have a long way to go, and the president said all this, but the fact that we can address our issues and repair our nation is what makes us great.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a simple idea, Catherine, and it's like all great ideas. It's kind of obvious when I'm talking about it, and everybody knows and gets it immediately. But what the president did was he expressed it beautifully and delivered the speech beautifully and made it sing, this kind of new idea that's really a very old idea, a very permanent and enduring idea of who we are as a people.
And moved more than, would you say, liberals and progressives? You said there were 25 Republicans who were there as well. You were left with a feeling that maybe some of these members of Congress would go back to Washington, D.C. and fix the Voting Rights Act.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too hopeful about it, so there's an emphasis on the maybe. But I think the Republicans were moved as well. And you couldn't help but be moved when you heard the stories that came out of Selma. And, you know, so a lot of them learned, for instance, that in Lowndes County, which is on the way from Selma to Montgomery, or, you know, right after you cross the bridge, you pretty quickly get into a county called Lowndes County. And before the Voting Rights Act 1965, it's a 80% African-American county, and there wasn't a single African-American voter in the county because the Klan, which, you know, was very powerful in the area, and the White Citizens Councils and the rest prevented anyone from voting. And then that changed very quickly after the Voting Rights Act. And now we met, the congresswoman from Selma is a Rhodes Scholar and Harvard Law School graduate, Congresswoman Sewell. The mayor is African-American. And while they don't have enough votes to elect an African-American statewide, they, you know, their community is represented as well as should be, as our Constitution requires. So I do think that a number of Republicans recognize that there is a Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Sensenbrenner.
From Wisconsin.
From Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Who has a bill, a good bill, that he's co-sponsored with John Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan, to fix the Voting Rights Act, as the Supreme Court instructed, all but instructed, in its most recent decision that invalidated portions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And so they understand that it needs to be fixed. It helped that President Bush and Laura Bush were there, and President Obama mentioned in his speech that both Presidents Reagan and President George W. Bush signed extensions of the Voting Rights Act. If they could do it, why can't the Republican Congress get on with it? And I do think that it created some momentum with some indications that Kevin McCarthy, the House Whip, and Senator Tim Scott, who is the only African-American Republican in the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction. Actually, take that back. Edward Brooke was there from Massachusetts, but one, you know, the only one currently, that they will go back and work seriously on moving the Sensenbrenner legislation, which right now is going nowhere in the Senate and has been kind of ignored in the House, and that this might reignite some attention for. One thing that was interesting that Nancy Pelosi told me, you know, lest people think that this is a partisan matter, it hasn't been in the past. As recently as 2006, the renewal of the Voting Rights Act passed unanimously in the Senate and with only 30 no votes in the House. So it wasn't until Republicans decided that as a political matter, they wanted to suppress the vote, not just of African Americans, but of anybody who might be likely to vote Democratic. It wasn't until that started happening that this became a partisan issue. And you know, skeptics might say, well, it's too late. You know, the Republicans, they're really dug into this voter suppression thing, and they're committed to this, but it really isn't. And the fact that Sensenbrenner is sponsoring this and that these 25 Republicans on the trip were open to at least, you know, taking a hard look at the renewal of the Voting Rights Act suggests that as long as the new bill doesn't single out Republican southern states as the original bill did, that's a dead idea. That's not going to happen anymore. As long as it applies to all 50 states, allowing people to sue if they believe they have been wrongly deprived of their right to vote, this legislation can move forward, but it's going to take a lot of your listeners and other people, you know, telling, cheering on Congressman Sensenbrenner, who I don't think hears very much from constituents about this, you know, to be told, you know, you're doing the right thing. This is a big deal. And we're glad that you're representing Wisconsin and moving forward on this legislation. I think if he started to hear that, he would then push his colleagues a little harder, and we might actually see some legislation.
Jonathan Alter is with us for this part of the program. Jonathan is a presidential historian, has written two books about President Obama, another book about FDR. He has written for all major news publications and has a really lovely piece in the Daily Beast this week because he was in Selma for the commemoration and spoke with members of Congress, with civil rights veterans, people who marched that bridge or tried to march the bridge 50 years ago, and descendants of people like Governor Wallace's daughter and Bobby Kennedy's daughter. And it's really a piece worth reading. And the president's speech is worth listening to. This is a bit of what there also is a movement afoot to rename the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which makes sense to me. It would have been nice to call it the John Lewis Bridge and had that be a part of the ceremony. I want to ask Jonathan about how small that movement is or if it's gaining momentum. And we'll take some of your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Before we go to your phone calls, just a bit of what the president had to say this weekend at that commemoration about the Voting Rights Act.
Right now, in 2015, 50 years after Selma, there are laws across this country designed to make it harder for people to vote. As we speak, more such laws are being proposed. Meanwhile, the Voting Rights Act, the culmination of so much blood, so much sweat and tears, the product of so much sacrifice in the face of wanton violence, the Voting Rights Act stands weakened. Its future subject to political rancor. How can that be? The Voting Rights Act was one of the crowning achievements of our democracy, the result of Republican and Democratic efforts. President Reagan signed its renewal when he was in office. President George W. Bush signed its renewal when he was in office. 100 members of Congress have come here today to honor people who are willing to die for the right to protect it. If we want to honor this day, let that 100 go back to Washington and gather 400 more and together pledge to make it their mission to restore that law this year. That's how we honor those on this bridge.
Our number is 800-486-8655. John in Elgin, Illinois is calling in. Jonathan, hi, John.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I grew up in the 50s on the south side of Chicago in Roseland, about a half a mile from the first housing development that was occupied by African Americans. And at that time, black people weren't allowed to ride the Chicago Transit Authority buses. So there was a South Suburban line that was owned by African Americans. And when I was young going to school, I would always take the South Suburban line, the black bus, because it was more interesting to me and I wanted to learn about other cultures, made a lot of friends that were African American. In the 50s and 60s, and it was still segregated, and I had an Irish cop at the end of my block who enjoyed winging, he used to call it winging black kids, kids that were 12, 14, 15. He'd shoot them in the hands and the wrist.
Ooh.
He didn't really hurt them, but he enjoyed that kind of sport. And I was always troubled by it. I became a community organizer. And one thing that I'm troubled by is in my lifetime I have heard the words colored, Negro. Now it's black and white. Black and white are diametrically opposed. One absorbs all color, one reflects all color. And I've never seen truly a black person. We need to introduce this, I think, into our national consciousness. I've never seen a black person, and I've never really seen a white person. We're all made of the same stuff, and we're all just different shades of color, and we all hopefully would have a commonly good heart and hope and help this country get through this horrible thing we've lived with for 200 years.
Jonathan.
I think it's really important to bear witness, as John is in this call, to the past, because, you know, it's receding from memory for younger Americans, for my kids' generation. You know, they didn't ever really see this kind of thing. Although when you look at something like Oklahoma State, you know, what happened
yes.
to the fraternity there, you know, we know that this kind of racism is alive and well. But, you know, I think it's important that we hear these kinds of stories like the one we just heard about the South Side of Chicago, and have discussions about language, because language, you know, as George Orwell, you know, wrote so brilliantly in a book called Politics and English Language, an essay, you know, it is deeply bound up with politics. So it is important what we call each other, and those kinds of conversations are important. But I also think that, you know, one of the things that I really liked about the president's speech, and I've been critical of the president in various areas and various speeches that I thought were underwhelming. But one of the things he did was he really gave hope, and he was so inspired by what happened on that bridge and after, you know, afterward, where LBJ said, you know, and we shall overcome. And then they passed the Voting Rights Act and change happened. And people in African-Americans in Lowndes County that went from none of them voting to large numbers of them voting almost overnight. You know, that change really can happen. And I think it's important for people to recognize this, that things can be extremely frustrating and it can seem like nothing is happening, nothing is changing, and people start getting disillusioned. And then there's a tipping point, and maybe some moral courage, like John Lewis showed, or some leadership like Martin Luther King showed, or just society being ready for it, as we saw with the very rapid change on gay marriage. And then suddenly everything changes almost in the blink of an eye. And so, you know, I think Kathleen, and I'm sorry, by the way, that I called you Catherine. I had an old friend, Kathleen Dunn.
That's fine.
I had the wrong name in my head from years ago. You know, I think that your listeners kind of get this, because Wisconsin has been at the center of a lot of change in this country. And something that a lot of people don't even know is that the idea of Social Security, for instance, started in Wisconsin. A number of other progressive ideas started in Wisconsin. Some not so good things like McCarthyism, you could
yes.
also say, started in Wisconsin. But, you know, your state has been central to this idea that government can be responsive, things can change if the constellation of forces is, you know, is the right one.
So how about, in 30 seconds we have left, changing the name of the bridge? I like this idea.
So, you know, I talked to various people about it, including Jesse Jackson, who I saw down there. There are a lot of people who like keeping the old name because it reminds everybody of segregationist past, and Edmund Pettus was a racist and segregationist. Other people think that they should do what was done at Hartsfield Airport in Atlanta, where they renamed it Hartsfield Jackson. So Hartsfield was the old, you know,
yeah.
old white Southerner, Maynard Jackson, who had been mayor.
I see. Call it both.
Mayor.
I like that.
So call it Pettus Lewis Bridge.
That's pretty dramatic.
Lewis Pettus
Bridge. I like it. Thanks, Jonathan. We're out of time. Jonathan Alter, our guest, his piece on his weekend in Selma will be on our Facebook page.